Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now do this for me. I want you to just close your eyes for a second if you can, safely, and imagine an apple. What do you see? Can you see the outline, or is it like a floating hologram? Maybe you can't see anything at all. If that's you, if you're drawing a blank and you can't see anything, then you might be part of the very small percentage of the population who lack mental imagery, a phenomenon known as aphantasia. And scientists have been fascinated by visual imagery for centuries, but recent studies using brain imaging are giving us new insights into what's happening. And we're joined now by Professor Ian Roberts of Trinity College Dublin and author of How Confidence Works. Robertson, to give you your proper name. Ian, lovely to see you again.
Nice to see you, Claire.
You wrote a book called The Mind's Eye, so you're the perfect person really for us to speak to about this. It's extraordinary because I'm sure there are people at home who closed their eyes, instantly saw the apple and are wondering, why can't some people do that?
That's right. And I'm personally, I can't see in colour really. I see a grey outline, but I can visualise it. Mm-hmm. But some people have amazing capacity to almost recreate the sensory image. And it's a very interesting ability. And
When people are talking about their mind's eye, what are they actually referring to? What is it that's happening?
So what it is the ability to recreate sensory experiences without the physical stimuli being there. So it's a bit like, tape recorder or a video recorder, a bit like that.
So is it a memory?
It draws on memory. So what it is, you have to draw on memory, because if you've never seen an apple, you can't visualize it. Mm-hmm. So yes, you have to have memory. So you have to access it from part of the brain called the temporal lobes. You have to access a memory of an apple, and then the front part of your brain sends instructions to the back part of your brain, which is the bit that would be activated if you actually saw an apple, giving it the instruction to create the pattern of brain cell activation that would correspond to an apple being seen.
Mm-hmm. So what is happening when people can't imagine an apple or a pair of scissors? This is what we were doing in the office yesterday, going through all of these items to see if we could. What is going on when that's not happening?
Well, there's a very recent study just come out. It hasn't been fully published yet, but which identifies a particular part of the temporal lobe in a part called the fusiform gyrus, which is a part of a network. So you've got your front part of your brain, the back part of your brain, you've got the memory centres in the temporal lobe, and there's a little part of the brain called the fusiform gyrus, which doesn't seem to switch on when people with aphantasia are trying to visualise something. So it's like just, there's a break in the network. Now, it may not be it's probably not a physical break. It may just be something with weak connections. And so it doesn't switch on enough to instruct the back part of the brain to create the visual image.
Is it hard to measure, though? Because you're relying on me to accurately describe what I'm seeing when I'm closing my eyes and imagining an image.
Yeah, we tend to mistrust self-reports and introspection, but actually they're remarkably valid, these measures. But there are clever ways you can test whether it's actually working. So there's things called binocular rivalry, where you present real stimulus to one eye and another competitor stimulus to the other, and you can look at the degree to which these support or interfere with each other. But you can also get people to imagine the competitor stimulus. And what you find is with people with aphantasia, you don't get binocular rivalry inhibition or effects, whereas in people who have got imagery ability, the imagined image interferes in the way that a real image would. So that's kind of objective evidence to support the subjective report.
So if you know someone has aphantasia, what else do you know about that person?
Well, we know that they're less good at what we call autobiographical memory, about remembering the last wedding you went to and remembering the imagining the people you were with, imagining the meal, visualizing the speeches. Mm-hmm. So, or the last time you went on holiday.
Names and dates, are they good at remembering those?
Well, names and dates are more stored in the verbal stores of the brain, so they don't need imagery to the same extent. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't necessarily be poor at them. It's the more emotional, personal event, what we call episodic memory, that's not so good in people with aphantasia. And they're also less good at imagining the future wedding, creating future images. And one of the upsides for an aphantasic person is they're less likely to become haunted by terrible imageries if they've had a traumatic experience.
It's less likely to stay with them and
it's
affect them.
It's less likely to stay with them because, you know, these images connect emotions and thoughts and memories and bind them together.
And as a follow-on to that then, are they less likely to have vivid dreams?
I haven't seen a study looking at that, but I'd be interested to know that. The answer is I don't know.
Mm.
Because if they can have vivid dreams, it means that definitely the fact that they can't do it when they're waking is more of a learning or a functional problem rather than a structural one in the brain.
Okay, so they just can't generate an image
at will.
So
yeah.
What is going on in our brain when we see something? So when I'm looking at you, you're looking at me, what are our brains doing?
So the left half of my left eye and the left half of my right eye take in the information from the left half of space and project it to the right part of my brain at the back and opposite for the right.
The right's doing it to the left.
Yeah. And so actually, when it comes to the very back of the brain, to the visual cortex, you're actually upside down and split in two halves. And your halves and one half of your face is in the right and the left. And then that information's passed forward in the visual cortex where it's assembled into clear burn, the right way up and whole, if you like. And that, so it means that even in ordinary perception, everything is a kind of constructed image anyway.
Yes, aren't our brains extraordinary?
It's a miracle that we manage to do this kind of stuff, talk and look and see and know. The computers are getting there, but they're nowhere near as good as we are, particularly at this kind of task of visual perception.
So that's what happens when we see something.
Yeah.
When we're imagining something or conjuring up an image, what's happening?
What's happening there is the frontal lobes of our brain are connecting to the memory centres and the temporal lobes. So they're saying, look, OK, let's get some files out of what apples look like. And then they're sending instructions, possibly via this fusiform gyrus, which we've only recently been pinpointed with very high resolution imaging, to then send instructions to the back of the brain, the visual cortex, to create the pattern of cell activation that corresponds to that image.
Okay.
And that means that you are actually seeing it. The people who can visualise very well are actually seeing it.
So a listener would like to know whether this condition exists on a spectrum. So they explain, I have very little visual memory, so I can't picture my old classrooms in school, but I can visualise an apple.
Yeah, well, that's possibly because they're you know, more experience of apples in recent years, and so the memory of an apple is much stronger form. So that's probably a memory thing rather than a visual imagery issue. The main thing is that visual imagery is incredibly useful particularly if we say children are learning stuff, or any adults are learning stuff. If you can attach visual images to your to the words or the names that you're trying to learn, you will store them better. Your memory will pluck them out because you're activating additional brain circuits.
Yes, and that's why it's always good if you're studying something to make notes, to physical notes rather than highlighting things.
Yes, that's right. And if you can draw little pictures, linked to the things you're trying to learn. Or if you've just introduced to some people at a party and you meet, you know, Rob White, if you can imagine him, you know, completely dressed in white, the more unusual and absurd the image you create, the more it will stick in your memory.
Yeah, you have this little technique where you ask people to, if they have a list that they need to remember, to put those items on a street.
Yeah.
So explain that to us.
Yeah, please. It's called, it was around about 2,000 years ago or longer. It's called either the method of loci, L-O-C-I, or the Roman room. So you either pick a little street, I think of between my house and the station, or a room that you're very familiar with. And you say you've got a list of six things you want to buy in the shop. And rather than write the list, you say, okay, I'll visualize putting the bread on top of the gatepost, the butter I've got stuck in a spike at the corner, the newspaper I've got lying on the pavement at the next corner, and then I've got the bacon sticking out of the post box, etc. And then that's a route you know well. So then when you get to the shop, you just rewalk the route. And you will remember them much better than if you just try to remember bread, newspaper, butter, bacon.
Yeah, and then get angry with yourself when you've forgotten the butter when you get back.
Yeah.
Ian, it's lovely to talk to you. As always, thank you very much for coming in. That's Professor Ian Robertson, back after this quick break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.